Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 28 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Bernie. Happy Friday.
And happy Friday to you, too. Richard, we have a live studio audience today.
I noticed.
We have Miss Cassie, who's back joining us again.
Miss Cassie's been here before.
She has.
This is a return visit.
And she didn't want to talk very much last time.
She's agreed to contribute this time?
Well, we might have to pry some information from her, but okay. We'll see how that goes. But we also have Dr. Ellen Suarez.
Finally.
Yes, we've wanted her to sit in with us for a long time now, and we're happy she's sitting in. She's not sure that she wants to talk either, but we will see how that goes. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
We're glad that you're here and being part of it. So today, the title of the podcast is Mental Illness in the Schools.
Finally talking about this topic.
Yeah, we have sort of been dancing around it, I think, in a lot of previous podcasts. And today, I think it's about time that we're just going to shoot straight right at it. And
let's make a direct assault on this thing. Yeah, it's an increasing concern that I have, especially given all the emphasis in schools these days on testing and Common Core and how many tests are we giving and who's going to be tested and what will they be used for. I think we're forgetting a segment of the school population,
right?
And that is kids who are mentally ill.
Absolutely, and we're working on a forum with some local agencies and everything on education because of the issues. And a lot of this came up the other day because we got a call from the Ledger, who we write for and we do a lot of work with and we love. We got a call from them and asking us some of our thoughts about education and what's going on in education, and it overlaps with this topic very, very closely.
Very nicely. Mm-hmm.
So we need to address it.
Okay.
So in thinking about that, let's just sort of start out talking about the numbers. All right. So what we know, and I think that we intuitively know this, or at some level we know this, but we don't really think about the magnitude. And that is about 20% of the American population have a mental health condition.
Right.
Okay. There is no reason to believe that is strictly adults.
Right.
A lot of evidence suggests that 1 in 5 or 20% of children also suffer from a mental health condition.
Right. That's the data suggests that 20% of school-aged children meet criteria for mental illness.
Right. And if we think about the statistics,
right,
it makes sense. I mean,
right,
we've talked before about how somewhere between 9 and 11 kids have ADHD.
Right.
We're over 1% of the population with autism spectrum disorders. Mm-hmm. We have a good 2 or 3% of the population, or sometimes more, depending on what you're looking at, with learning disabilities, with depression, with anxiety. So those numbers very quickly add up, and we get to about that 20% of the population, even if we recognize that some of those conditions are co-occurring. So if 20% of the population have a mental health condition, the other sort of part of that we have to recognize is that about half of them, or about 10% of the population, somewhere between 5 and 10% of the population, have a serious mental health condition, something
right,
that impairs functioning.
And I think that's the group that we really need to focus on, that I would like to focus on today, is the 10% of school-age children. This is 10% of K-12 students are seriously impaired,
right,
by a mental illness. Now, there are 50 million school children in the United States, and so we're talking about 10% of this. So we're talking about 5 million children
right.
who are seriously mentally ill, who go to school every day.
Right.
That's where they're getting treatment.
Right.
If any treatment occurs, it's occurring in schools.
Right. Okay. And if we're thinking about 1 in 10, that's 2 kids in your kid's classroom.
If there's a classroom of 20 students, 2 of them have a serious mental illness.
Right.
Right.
Right. And again, obviously, of course, in some locations, some demographic locations, the concentration right. is even higher.
Yeah, what's happening today, when you start tracking, you know, most people believe in tracking. There isn't any research to support that it does any good. But when you start segregating children into magnet schools and charter schools and tracking, the students who are left behind are going to have a higher concentration of kids with mental illness. So instead of having 2 out of 20, you might have 5 or 6 out of 20 kids in right. a classroom who are mentally ill.
Richard, you're pulling out a soapbox that I'm going to try to avoid us getting on, because we're creating a 2-tier education system, and we're going to...
Another topic?
That's another topic for another day. We can't do that one today, because that's another really important thing for us to talk about. But with that in mind,
yes,
what we're really talking about is this huge percentage of kids with mental health conditions and mental illness.
Right.
Richard, the evidence also suggests, and we're talking about a lot of evidence here, also suggests that up to 2/3, 66 to about 70% of those with mental illness, mental health conditions, do not receive treatment.
They never get, and that figure might be as high as 80%.
Right.
Who of these children, about 70 to 80% never get treatment.
Right.
Right. They have no access.
So who provides treatment?
Classroom teachers.
Classroom teachers.
That do as well as they can, given the training that they receive.
Right. Mm-hmm. And again, admittedly, receive very little training.
That's right. I'm part of a teacher. Well, we both have been part of teacher preparation training programs at major universities. And most elementary school teachers are going to receive one course that in special education that touches on these issues.
Right.
And it's just not sufficient.
And a lot of that course is on classroom
management.
So they right. learn how to make rules for the classroom, how to arrange the classroom, and those kinds right. of things. But it, you know, in a 16-week course,
right.
you can't touch on everything that's important for how do you deal with kids with ADHD? How do you deal with kids with autism spectrum
right.
disorders? They just don't have the opportunity
no.
to do that.
Unless a teacher has dealt with mental illness in his or her family, they know virtually, they're the first ones to tell you, I don't know anything about these disorders. And I don't know what to do about it. I don't know how to recognize it. I don't know how to separate whether a person has a mental illness or is just misbehaving. They don't know what to do about it.
Right. But yet, you know, we place these teachers in a situation where they're in front of 20 students, 2 of which statistically has a mental health
right.
condition.
Mm-hmm.
And we're expecting them, those teachers, to teach all of those students at the same pace, all the same material.
Right.
And then the teacher is going to be graded on it at the end of the year.
Right.
Based upon the student's performance.
Mm-hmm. Academic performance.
Academic performance.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, it sounds like insanity, but it is what our current school system does. So with the acknowledgement of the statistics, what the statistics say as it relates to mental illness in the schools, what is contributing to this? Why, or Richard, and this is my question to you, why do you think that prevalency rate is so high now? Do you think that it's been the same way forever, or do you think that it's higher now than it used to be?
The prevalence of mental illness in the population?
Yeah, we've heard these guys come out and talk about how, well, there just wasn't ADHD before the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Before the invention of methylphenidate, Ritalin, mm-hmm. there wasn't any such thing as ADHD in the schools.
Right. No, I think that 2 things have happened. One is, of course, we've become better at identifying
right.
individuals with mental illness. We're better at recognizing and diagnosing them. The second problem is partly genetic. There's something called accession. And when a disorder enters the gene pool, and I think we've talked about this before on the program, when a disorder enters the gene pool, it will appear with increasing virulence and increasing frequency in each succeeding generation. And so I think that's the other thing we're seeing. The third contributing factor is that neonatal medicine has advanced to the point where we can save many infants who two or three generations ago would not have survived the birth process. They're surviving now, but they are genetically vulnerable to these disorders. So I think there are three contributing factors.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And we're not saying that while there's an increase in prevalence, mm-hmm. You know, we certainly don't want anyone to leave with the impression that these issues and these conditions and disorders did not exist.
That's right.
Prior to the 1950s.
They all existed prior to the 1950s or 60s or 70s.
We have fidgety Phil from hundreds of years ago. We have all of these anecdotal stories and reports of students with ADHD symptoms, students with autistic-like symptoms, kids with Tourette's disorder from years and years and years ago. Well before we had them labeled.
Yeah, violent rage attacks in children are not, they're not new, it's not a new phenomenon.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. So these things have been around. Sure, they're increasing in prevalence, and there's a likelihood that there's multiple factors that contribute to that, mm-hmm. Some of which happen in the school as well.
Right.
There are some things that are happening in the schools today that we believe, I believe, I don't want to automatically put Richard into this camp, though I think he will happily join. There are many things that we're doing in the school systems that are contributing to this mental illness prevalence.
I'm in that camp. In fact, what we've been talking about so far is that 80% are not being treated. The other side of that coin is that schools are doing things which are making things worse for this segment of the school population. This 10 or 20% who are vulnerable, we say mentally ill. The question I think that needs to be addressed is not only are schools doing enough for them, but the second question is are schools doing things that are making it worse
right.
for this group?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is a good point for us to you know, organizing this a little bit so that hopefully it makes sense to everybody. You know, what we're talking about is when we're talking about mental illness, we're talking about impairments in functioning, which suggests that the student has difficulty performing or meeting some form of expectation. So they can't perform academically because of a mental health condition. They can't perform socially because of a mental health condition. They are not doing well at home. They're not doing well in public. They're not functioning in some way. We're not just talking about those kids who are, you know, sad for a couple of days because their goldfish died. We're not talking about kids who are a little bit stressed out because, you know, they have a spelling test today. We're not talking about those students. We're talking about kids who have serious mental health conditions that are pervasive, that affect them on an almost daily basis.
Every day.
Mm-hmm. Whether there's an acute stressor or not, this is something that affects them every day.
Right.
And I think, you know, Richard, we were talking about it the other day, and you brought up a good point, and that is that this almost becomes an issue when we talk about the way that mentally ill students or students with mental illness are managed in the school system. You mentioned that this is almost an issue of diversity. You know, we work really hard in the schools to recognize different students' needs based upon their individual cultural and ethnic experiences. And I think that we could argue that considering a student's mental health condition could be an issue with diversity.
It is. When we talk about diversity, we typically think of racial and ethnic groups.
Right.
But another group are children with mental illness. Another definable group, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity, are children who are mentally ill.
Right.
Okay.
And so you know, let's use an example really quick. Certainly, we're not talking about a group of kids who need special holidays or special considerations as it relates to religious observances or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But we are certainly talking about the way in which these kids tend to process the world around them.
Exactly.
They mm-hmm. experience their environment in a very different way.
They experience it and they react to it
right.
in a very different way.
And that And even all of the kids within that group don't do it the same way.
Right.
And so what happens, and we'll kind of touch on this again in a little bit, you know, we get into situations where we, and I was just talking to a teacher about this week, you know, we look at a student's behavior and we assume that it's intentional, volitional behavior.
Right.
And we're not taking into account, sort of using the word diversity, the diverse nature of behavioral intent.
Mm-hmm.
or what causes behaviors to happen, or, you know, where behaviors come from. And when we don't appreciate it from a perspective of a diversity, we start to lump all the behavior together and assume that it's the same and all with the same purpose and all with the same intent.
Right.
And that's a dangerous thing.
I think this issue of volitional control, the assumption that is too often made is that a student is choosing to misbehave. We frequently hear people, go to any place where you see parents and children and they say, oh, you're making bad, you'll hear the adults say, oh, you're making bad choices. It's a common response, common reaction. With this group of 10 or 20% of students, I think we have to do away with this notion of you're making bad choices, because the first assumption always is you're doing it on purpose, or you're doing it to get attention, or
right.
you're doing it to get something. These children don't misbehave just to get something.
Right.
This is not voluntary deviance. In fact, we use the term in our presentations, we use the term involuntary deviance.
Right.
They are different, but it's involuntary deviance. They're not asking for this. Nobody asks for this. Nobody asks to be sick, and nobody asks to be mentally ill.
Right.
So these are not volitional acts.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking about this high school student that I was talking to yesterday, and he didn't finish his math test mm-hmm. yesterday. And so he went up to the math teacher afterwards, and this is something that I've talked to the student to do. And I said, you know, when you don't get it finished, go talk to the teacher, because he processes, he reads a little bit slower, he processes right. a little bit slower. Very smart kid, but just at a slower pace. And the teacher's first response was, you can't work on this later because, you know, you're just trying to go back and study
right.
more so that you can come back and make a better
right.
grade.
Right.
And
he's
that, of course,
being accused of something,
right? Mm-hmm. Like he's trying to cheat, and
right.
you know, when the kid told me about it, he was why would I do that?
right.
And so
right.
these kids are not mm-hmm. intentionally seeking
right.
to anger us or to be defiant or anything like that.
Right.
It's just how they process information.
Right. And how many of your kids come in and they'll say, I don't know why I did it.
Right.
I don't know why I did it. They really don't.
Right.
Know? Or they say, I just forgot. They really did just forget.
Right. Yeah. So this really is, you know, if we think about the broad sense of the term diversity, we really are talking about the need for a different approach or a different way of thinking about these students. Mm-hmm. And we need to see them as another group. And we have to think about what they're thinking about.
Right.
So if we approach it from that perspective, I think what it does is it opens the doors for us to have a different appreciation and different responses to these students when they're acting out or when they engage in a behavior that's problematic for us for some reason.
Right. That's right.
So so it begins with our perspective. It begins with the perspective of the teacher and the administrators. And we'll get to the code of conduct stuff here in just a few minutes, because I know that that's yet another soapbox that we'll want
that's
to...
That's right. Multiple soapboxes this morning.
That's right. We have lots of soapboxes. So let's talk about how we're handling mental illness right now. Right now, we're not thinking about it from the perspective of diversity. We are looking at it, for the most part, as intentional behavior that is... you know, an issue, a problem. So let's think about how we're handling it right now. And the truth is, we're not handling it very well. Right now, what we're doing is we have policies in place that include zero tolerance, include the code of conduct, which results in blind assessments and blind applications of consequences and punishments that really oftentimes don't make sense.
Right. You know, we really have two, when we talk about how we're managing it, we really have two forces that are driving the decision making. One is zero tolerance. Zero tolerance comes from Columbine. I mean, when the school shootings occurred back in the 90s, when we had that epidemic of school shootings that began in the late 90s, there was a knee-jerk response, and we ended up with zero tolerance policies. And those zero tolerance policies trapped, ensnared these kids with mental illness because they are involuntarily deviant. They were constantly getting into trouble. So one problem is the severe reaction response on the part of school districts to zero to what was labeled misbehavior in children that fell under the zero tolerance policies. Zero tolerance policies are being done away with in more and more school districts. I mean, right. we realize that they didn't solve the problem. But there's a second thing driving this process, and that is that the focus today, the obsession today, is with the assessment of students.
Right.
Okay. I don't care what we call it, but when you go into schools today, all that is being focused on in most school districts is the assessment of students and the evaluation of students, teachers, administrators, and school districts.
Right.
Okay? When that happens, there is very little time, money, energy spent on children who have these needs.
Right.
Okay. So number one, we're ensnaring them in zero tolerance policies, and number two, no one's paying attention to their needs.
Right.
Because the focus is on assessment.
Right. It goes back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, that we have a teacher in a classroom of 20 students, several of which likely have mental health conditions, mm-hmm. mental health problems.
Right.
But yet the teacher is responsible for teaching them all just the same.
That's
with
right.
the same materials in the same way.
Right.
And we're not providing them the resources they need to, again, recognize the diversity that is their student population and teach them accordingly.
That's right. We put these children in these classrooms, whether it's children who don't understand and speak English,
right.
whether it's children who don't understand the culture, whether it's children who are mentally ill, it doesn't matter. They're in these regular classrooms, and the teacher is told, deal with them, deal with it, do the best that you can, and make sure that your class does well, because if they don't test well at the end of the year, that's going to be, the teacher's going to be held accountable for that.
Right.
Okay, that's what teacher accountability is all about. And so again, these children are put in a terribly disadvantageous position because of the way schools are structured today, and they are being ignored.
Right, right. And so in all of that fosters, it exacerbates in many cases, many of these mental health issues, whether it's anxiety,
that's right.
It's depression, all of these contribute to those issues and make them worse.
Yeah, imagine a child with depression, a typical high school student, with a diagnosis of depression, now goes into an algebra class, doesn't understand what's going on, can't get help. Guess what it's going to do to his depression or to her anxiety?
Right.
It's going to exacerbate the condition. And there's nobody there who can help that kid.
Right, right. Right. So, you know, and it reminds me of a teacher that we spoke to not too long ago, who, you know, he's a math teacher. And he,
yes.
you know, he teaches ninth grade math. And last year, in the end of course exam, I think the estimates were somewhere between 85% and 90% of the students failed the test.
Right, right.
Failed the test.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and when they go back and they look at the test, of course, the teachers and other people know that the test is written at a level far above ninth grade level.
Right.
For one, but then you know. The people come back, the administrators come back, the state administrators come back and say, oh no, these were valid tests. So we're left to believe that these students who many times passed the school year, passed their class
the course,
material,
right. mm-hmm.
But then failed this test.
Right.
Well, it was a good evaluation of their overall abilities
right.
based upon these
it's
state
a valid assessment.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right. And so much of this is really hitting the news now because there was the report from California, where they're going back and they're taking out their end of year exams, and they're trying to track down students from back in 2006 who were not allowed to graduate because of failing the test.
I meant to look up the number. It's either 26,000 or 76,000 students in California who were not given diplomas because they failed the state test. And so now the state of California is using Facebook and what other things do people use? Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram to try to Twitter to try to locate these tens of thousands of students.
Yeah.
To give them their diplomas. Now they're going to grant them their diplomas.
Yeah.
After the, since 2006. And the encouraging part of that is that you and I have discussed many times, how do we fix these problems? And I'm hopeful that this action by somebody showing good judgment in California will be the beginning of the undoing of the craziness that we're all experiencing in education, in public education today.
Right.
Private schools don't have to worry about it. But I was very encouraged when I saw that article that,
right.
that finally somebody's using a sensible approach. It's too bad we have to go back and clean up the mess,
right.
but let's go back and clean up the mess and let's make it better going forward.
Well, and what's so sad about it is, you know, that's 9 years.
Yeah.
9 years that have passed. And you think about all the students who couldn't go into the military, who probably couldn't find good jobs because, you know, it's tough to find a good job when you don't have when you're not a high school graduate. Couldn't go to college, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully, we'll cross fingers that many of those people ended up getting maybe GEDs or something like that so they could continue. But
yeah, I taught a class last night at the university to graduate students, and I happened to mention the California decision, and the first response was, yeah, but that was 9 years ago. Their lives have already been ruined. These people are in their late 20s.
Right.
Some of these people in their late 20s, their lives have already been wrecked by not having a high school diploma.
Right.
And that was their first response.
Yeah. So it's a step in the right direction, but you think about all the lives that have been affected so far. Mm-hmm. It's pretty, it's sad, devastating for some.
Yeah. Another soapbox. Continue.
So you're right. When it comes to these this assess model that we're using right now, where everything we're doing is testing. Mm-hmm. You know, we just wrote a column a couple of weeks ago for the Ledger about you know, this new end of year exams now that we're doing, so that we're adding new tests, new layer of expectations on students. And, you know, going back to that teacher, that math teacher that I was talking about a minute ago, you know, they're already having to tell the students, the principal is already telling them, they have to tell the students that you have this end of year exam this year and that exam is going to count for 30% of your final grade. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pass that test, you may not pass the course.
Right.
So students, you know, anxious students are already completely freaked out by this.
Right.
Students who, you know, sort of have that neurologic underarousal that we talk about often, you know, those students are, I don't care, you know, who cares? And so they're not even trying anymore.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we're creating this culture of, with some of these students of, you know, accepting the fate that, you know, this isn't going to work.
Right.
And so they're not trying. And so what motivation now do they have to do well in school, to go to school?
Right.
What is their motivation to try to graduate? Because if they don't pass this end of course exam, they're not going to get that credit. And if they don't get that credit here in the state of Florida, if you don't pass Algebra 1, you don't graduate.
Right. I had a mother come in the other day, and she was trying to figure out how many tests her daughter was going to have to take and in what subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to the school, and she went all through the teachers, administrators. She couldn't figure out, nobody could give her a clear answer of how many tests there were, in what subjects they were, who was going to make the tests, and how much they would count. So she's trying to get her daughter ready between now and March, when these tests are typically given. They couldn't even give her a clear answer of how many tests her daughter's going to have to take, or what they will mean in evaluating her and her teachers.
Well,
there's some committee now that's been named to sort this all out, a committee of teachers, at a district level to figure out what the tests are and who's going to take them.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, here in we're in Central Florida, here in Polk County, the way that we understand it, that it will break down is take your typical ninth grader. Say 10th grader. That way we have biology included. The typical 10th grader will take an end of course exam in geometry,
right,
and an end of course exam in biology.
Right.
And I think U.S. history is 10th yes. grade. Mm-hmm. So they'll take an end of course exam in U.S. history. So there's three end of course exams that are created by the state that they will have to take. The other four classes that they take will have end-of-year exams, whether it's PE or it's language arts, yeah. English 2. They're going to have an end-of-year exam that's created by that committee that you were just talking about here in Polk County mm-hmm. That, again, will count for 30% of their grade. And that test, created by this committee here in the district, may be based upon a textbook that the students didn't even use in school.
That's right, because the end of year test is not it's not constructed by the child's teacher.
Right.
And it's not based on the materials that teacher has used.
Right.
That test is made up by a committee that has never met these kids and has no notion of what's going on
right.
in that course.
Right. And so we have this situation for this 10th grade student. So we'll have seven mm-hmm. exams, three end of course right. exams, four end of year exams, in addition to the FSA test that they have to pass if they want to graduate high school.
I'm sorry, I'm smiling because, so this kid is going to take seven tests and neither he nor his teacher have ever seen any of them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we wonder why kids are stressed out today. What do teenagers have to be stressed out about? And we hear that from adults all the time. You know, what do they have to be stressed out about?
That's right, they're kids.
They're kids. What do they have to be nervous about? But this is the climate that the students are in at school. Mm-hmm. And they're hearing this routinely.
Right.
You know, again, you know, some of the teachers that we've talked to and high school teachers we've talked to say, we're told to remind the students that these tests are coming at the end of the year, that they better stay on top of things right. because we can't slow down.
Right.
We have to make sure that we get all of this material covered
right.
before the test because the teachers
the test is coming.
Are responsible for that. Right. Mm-hmm. So you have that issue and that in and of itself stresses the students out and, you know, it's a whole other craziness that we deal with when we think about the anxiety and stress that puts on the teacher because right. the teacher is now responsible for the grades that these students get. Mm-hmm. And so you have all these students who are stressed out, those kids who give up, and the teacher is saying, wait a minute, you know, my performance is based upon what is graded up based upon what you do. Right. And if you don't care, what am I going to do about it? You know, what does the teacher do?
The teacher's not allowed to do anything.
Right.
If a student in high school decides not to do her work, the teacher is not allowed to intervene. That's a right that the student has. If a student decides to sleep in class, there are teachers who are... Teachers, I was told by a teacher that they are not allowed to intervene. If a student comes into class and chooses to sleep, student's right.
So again,
I'm just saying
this is
what the teachers are telling me.
Right. Okay. Right. So as we bring it back to our topic of mental illness in the schools, you know, these are contributing factors. These are things that we're doing right now that's likely worsening,
making it worse.
Right. This the climate for these students.
And I think it's important to say we're not criticizing teachers, we're not criticizing school personnel. What we're saying is schools, the way schools are structured today and the emphasis on standards and assessment are working against 20% of the students who
right.
are enrolled in schools. And my issue is that because we don't have any... People are always surprised when they hear that there's no place to send kids who are mentally ill. We don't have children's hospitals. We don't have mental institutions for anybody.
Right.
least of all children.
Right.
Okay. So these kids go to school every day. My complaint, my concern is that if schools are going to admit children with mental illness, then we have a moral obligation to deal with those kids.
Right.
And the system is not structured to deal with those structures. And in fact, the way it's structured today, it's actually making things worse.
Right. Because the flip side of this academic pressure that we're placing on students, not to rehash what we were mentioning a few minutes ago, is that we're then dealing with behaviors, right. Refusal, sleeping in class, and those kinds of things, and we're approaching that from a non-intellectual perspective.
Right.
We're using code of conduct. We're using zero tolerance. Mm-hmm. Where we end up, you know, like the case we had here in Florida with the high school senior who was set to graduate within a couple of weeks, being expelled from school because there was a plastic knife in her car.
Right.
She didn't take the knife out. She didn't take the knife into the classroom. Right. The knife was just visible through the window by the school resource officer, as the school resource officer was walking by, saw the plastic knife in the floorboard,
right.
And they found out whose car it was, and she was expelled, not allowed to graduate,
right.
Because there was a plastic knife. Because that's what zero tolerance policy says. That's what the code of conduct reads,
mm-hmm.
And it doesn't bring any logic to the situation.
No.
So we're this is what we're doing to our students.
Right.
And again, we wonder why students are struggling with stress, why they're struggling with depression, why we have so much self-harming behaviors, students who are cutting themselves and self-injuring behaviors, why we have, why students in high school commit suicide. You know, we wonder why the students sense so much pressure or experiencing so much pressure. Mm-hmm. And we're quite literally pushing the pressure on them.
Yeah, more and more parents are expressing behaviors, self-destructive behaviors, self-harm behaviors, and maybe they should, because in the last two decades, the suicide rate among children between the ages of 10 and 14 has more than doubled.
Yeah.
And so this is an increasing concern of parents. They see their children being stressed.
Right.
And so it is a concern.
Right. So we need to in this podcast with a plan, I think. You're looking at me like you don't know where I'm going.
No, you know what? I don't want to end it yet.
Oh.
I'm not finished.
No, we have more time, but I want to make sure that
we... How much time do we have, by the way?
We have about 20 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we're doing fine.
Why are you winding it down?
I'm not winding it down. I want to make sure that we spend this last third of the podcast on what we need to do about it.
Okay.
Because that is... that is where we
need important to, issue, we need to right. shift here. That's what everybody wants to know when we go out and do our talks. They say, well, what should we do about it?
Right.
So, good.
Something we've talked about for years is we have talked about how when this shift began towards more assessment and the pressure that we were just talking about as it relates to testing and everything, when all of that began, what we saw in our schools is a huge shift in the nature of the relationships between the students and the teachers.
Oh, yeah, right.
Teachers began to view students as, these are obstacles in the way of me being able to be promoted, to getting the reviews that I need to get, to getting the funding that I need to get. These students are obstacles. And you and I have, I know we've very... in very sad ways, experienced situations where schools and teachers really just want to get students out because those students are going to damage what the school's grade would be, what the teacher's performance would be, and things like that. Mm-hmm. And what we have to, I think that the first thing that we have to do in remedying this situation is we have to return to a time where the teachers and students had a positive relationship.
I think you're right. One of the worst unintended consequences, and there are dozens of unintended consequences of this assessment process, is that it has created an adversarial relationship between teachers and students.
Right.
Students are no longer seen as young folks who need my help. They're now seen as, this person could ruin my career.
Right.
This individual could really be a detriment to me.
Right.
And that is a fundamental shift in the student-teacher relationship.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I remember back in the mid-90s, so right. just as a lot of this stuff was starting, mm-hmm. I was working in Hillsborough County at University of South Florida. And one of the programs that we did when I was working with Dr. Archie Silver, we had this system where we would go into the schools. Right. Myself and some psychiatrists, we would go into the schools and work mm-hmm. with them. And I remember one of the schools that we worked at where, goodness, the school social worker knew every student at the school,
right.
knew every student's parent, had them mm-hmm. on her speed dial, you know, mm-hmm. on her speed dial,
right.
and she would go to their homes. Mm-hmm. If she went to the classroom and a student wasn't there, she was out in her car and she was driving to their house to find out where the student is.
Right. Right.
And those kinds of situations are gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, if a student falls asleep in class, many teachers are told you don't do anything about it.
Right.
If a student doesn't show up for school, they're mm-hmm. not doing anything about it.
Right.
Because, you know, the focus is we have X amount of material that we have to get through in this, you know, 1.5 hours. And it doesn't matter if you're here or not here. We have to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what situation is going on at home. I don't care what's happening outside of the classroom building.
Mm-hmm.
When you're here, you're going to learn this algebra, and that's it.
This is what I'm going to be doing while you're here.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we have to, I believe it's critical that we return to a situation where parents and teachers and students are all working together.
Right.
And I think part of this is on both sides, because we certainly have heard from parents as well who say, no. When he's at school, he's your problem.
Right.
Just like we hear from teachers who say, no, once he leaves here, not our problem.
Right.
And, you know, we have to return to the system where we're all working together.
Right.
Where students, you know, feel like and know that their teacher cares
mm-hmm.
about what they're doing, what's happening. Right. Because, there was that research article just, 5 years ago that was saying that when a student knows that a teacher cares, their
right.
performance increases significantly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we have to return to that. We have to encourage that to happen in the schools.
Right, right. Yeah, we know we can make these things better. I mean, the intervention data suggests even mental illness, if people are treated, if they get intervention for their mental illness, things are going to get better. All the data suggests that.
Right.
The trouble is we're not providing the interventions.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's the second part. That's the next thing we have to do.
Right.
You know, we have to stop. You know, we did our podcast last week on stigma.
Right.
And the schools is another place that the stigma is pervasive.
Alive and well.
It's horrible. And we, again, continue to work from this idea that it doesn't exist, and it blows my mind, because all of the evidence is there that it does exist, that it is a pervasive problem.
The stigma.
Right.
The stigma exists, right?
That the stigma exists, and that there are these students
mm-hmm.
who need help. They need not necessarily even accommodations, but just awareness needs to be available that these students need to be managed in this way, or this kind of information needs to be provided.
And of the soapboxes that I brought with me this morning, that's the biggest one. Okay. Okay. So, and the reason is because one of the questions that we are constantly asked when we do talks around the country to teachers is how do I differentiate between a child who's just misbehaving and a child who has a mental illness? That's an incredibly important question that very few people are talking about. We have to begin to differentiate between mental illness and bad behavior.
Right.
I even hate to use the phrase bad behavior. I hate the whole concept of bad behavior, because typically the kids who are creating the most behavior problems in school are probably those with mental illness.
Right.
Okay. But are we? How do we differentiate? And then second, what do we do about it?
Right.
And we don't have those systems in place in most schools.
Right.
Okay. And teachers have a right to be concerned about that.
Right.
They know that there's something wrong, but nobody's giving them assistance. There's one program in Connecticut that we need to get more information about, and apparently they are training teachers to recognize mental illness, and they're providing supports for teachers who are dealing with kids with mental illness. So
Right. There's
a glimmer of hope somewhere. We're going to get more information about that program. We'll report on it another time.
Right, right. And what we talk about in our workshops and stuff is providing education. You know,
Right. Teaching
teachers
Right. How
to how to observe, how to appreciate some of these behaviors, and
Right. How
to evaluate what is really going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just look at a student who's sitting in the back of the room and make it, you know, tapping his fingers and playing
mm-hmm.
drums with his pencil and say, oh, you know, that's such an annoying kid.
Right, right.
You have to look at that kid and evaluate them with the eye of, you know, what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. If he could sit there quietly, he probably would.
Right.
And so if he's not, then as Ross Green would say, it's a lagging skill that this kid
Right. Doesn't
have.
That's right.
We need
the
to provide him.
The skill that he doesn't possess.
Right. Mm-hmm. We need to provide him with the skills necessary to
mm-hmm.
meet our expectations.
Right.
And when we, as soon as, it's amazing, as soon as we make that shift in perspective,
mm-hmm.
everything changes.
Right. That's right.
But teachers and many times administrators have to be taught how to understand that, taught how to appreciate that, and taught how to assess that.
That's right.
Because, granted, there are kids who will do things just to annoy people.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that they're bad kids, necessarily.
Right. Right.
It just means that they're doing something that's, you know, that is eliciting some response from you that they're kind of digging right now.
Right.
And so you have to appreciate that and respond to that in an appropriate way to decrease that behavior from happening. So a lot of what we do, and again, a lot of the ways that these issues should be handled in the schools, is through this education.
Mm-hmm.
We have to teach teachers how to manage this or
how to
evaluate this.
Right. And we have to help them differentiate between what is just junky behavior, just junk behavior. You know, it just wants to have fun today. Okay. That's
right.
William Glasser would say that one of the reasons kids misbehave is sometimes they want to have fun. Okay. But we have to help teachers differentiate between a child who is, you know, garden variety misbehavior versus a child who's mentally ill.
Right.
We have to begin to equip teachers with that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. What will help with that, I think, what will help with what we're just talking about, as well as the relationship, is reevaluating this assessment process that we do. You know, teachers, understandably, are under a great deal, a tremendous amount of pressure. Administrators are under a tremendous amount of pressure because of this testing regime that we're under right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we find a way to relax that, much maybe the way that California is doing, and you know, Diane Ravitch talks about the opt-out movement and some things about, you know, she's really attacking this idea of high-stakes testing and everything.
Right. Mm-hmm.
If we follow some of those leads,
Right. What
we'll find is that that the pressure will be relieved. And when the pressure is relieved, teachers are going to be much more available emotionally
mm-hmm.
to have that relationship, to be able to examine student behavior and to sort of take the time needed to say, well, you know, he's not deliberately trying to drive me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
This may be something else, and let me give him some skills that he needs to
Right. To
be able to do what I ask him to do.
So one of the things we would call for is let's make some systemic changes,
right?
And address those things that are making mental illness worse.
Right.
Okay, so that would be one step in the right direction.
Right.
And one of the things that's making it worse are these high-stakes assessments for kids with mental illness.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I agree with you on that one. What else?
Well, I'm glad. The other one is the way that we deal with behavioral issues to begin with. And you mentioned earlier the idea of the restorative practices,
the restorative justice.
The restorative justice movement that's happening in a lot of schools already.
Right.
And I really think this is a good idea. I mean, it's certainly moving us in the right direction. And what the idea of that is that if a student does engage in a behavior that's very problematic,
right,
such as having a plastic knife in her car,
right,
or biting a chicken nugget to make it look like a gun.
Oh, yeah, the kid, but what was it, a Pop-Tart?
Yeah, the Pop-Tart.
Shoot a Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun and got expelled.
Yeah. So when those things happen, we can bring some logic to the discussion and say, hey, you know what? He didn't. It's not a real gun. It's a Pop-Tart. You know, the nutritional issues aside.
Yes.
The gun.
Another soapbox.
That's right. The gun-shaped Pop-Tart isn't going to kill anybody.
It's not a lethal weapon.
So why are we acting and responding to this in such a dramatic, life-changing way? Mm-hmm. We know it's clear in the research that the best way to get a student to drop out of school is to suspend them.
To suspend them.
Or to make them repeat a grade.
Increases the chances. One suspension increases the chance of ending up in the juvenile justice system by a factor of 4.
Right.
Mm-hmm. One suspension.
And we're talking about suspending kindergartners. Mm-hmm. So he's got 12 more years that where he's going to potentially, you know, and the teachers out there know that when a student is suspended, mm-hmm. the next year, the next teacher is going to be very sensitive to those behaviors and very likely to say, oh, yeah. You're out of here again.
You're out of here, right.
Not just the teacher, but the administrators and everybody else. Because right. they carry, you know.
And it is in their best interest to get rid of that kid because, once again, he's become an obstacle.
Right.
Right.
And sadly, when that kid's younger brother comes through, he's going to be seen as, remember his brother.
Must be
he
one
was
of
the
those.
One that, you know,
just like his brother.
Tried to shoot people with Pop-Tarts.
Right.
So then that kid is labeled or identified or marked as a potential troublemaker. And so any movement outside of the lines of expectation is going to be responded to impulsively and dramatically in such a way that it's going to affect them well down the road. Mm-hmm. So we have to change these our approach to dealing with behavioral issues.
And our attributions, you know, what we attribute these things to.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the restorative justice perspective is really good because what it does is it sort of, if a student did something to harm another student, then those two students get together and work it out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or a student damages something.
Right.
You fix it. Restorative justice, you restore it to its original state. You broke it, now you fix it.
Which is natural consequence, which is exactly what we teach in psychology, what we teach students, what we want parents to do at home. Mm-hmm. Naturally occurring consequences are the most, the strongest, most effective, most powerful consequences that you can have.
And as we say in our book, teach, don't punish. And these zero tolerance policies are meant to punish.
Right.
Okay? So, but instead we should be teaching, not punishing.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So, so when it comes to repairing some of the damages that we've done to these students with mental illness, students who are even on the mild end of mental health concerns, those That's students right. who have just a little bit of anxiety that flares up at times, flares up usually around February
around
or March.
February, March.
Those students with a little bit of depression that kind of hits them for a little while and then they seem to be okay for a while, but then it returns. So even those kids who aren't intensely impaired, a lot of what we're doing now is exacerbating that. And if we just make a few, it just feels like it's just a few small changes. Mm-hmm. We're not saying don't test kids. We're not saying that kids shouldn't be held to a level of expectations. Mm. But the way that we're currently doing it, it is really overboard. Mm-hmm. It's exaggerated. It's too punitive. And we really have to re-examine that and look at what we're doing to kids.
And one of the questions I think that needs to be asked, and I think we need to have a discussion about it, is do schools really need to be these high-pressure daily grinds in order to be successful? You know, so first of all, how do we define success? What do we want of these students?
Right.
So number one. And number two, do schools have to have this kind of pressure? Because that's what has seeped into the educational system, is an enormous amount of pressure on everybody, as though we're running some kind of business where we have to account for quarterly profits. We're not. That's not how schools were ever designed to function.
Right.
And so I think that's one of the first questions we have to discuss is, do schools really have to create this kind of pressure? And I think the answer to that is clearly no, they don't have to. But what can we do instead?
Right.
I think that's another discussion we need to have.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, a lot of this is driven by high-achieving adults.
That's right.
Who say, well, if I would have started studying law when I was in middle school, just think about what kind of an attorney I could be now.
Right.
So, you know, we should really make these middle school students start choosing what they're going to do for their profession, mm-hmm. you know, now. Mm-hmm. And you know, at some level, I can appreciate that because some kids do know. You know, I've met middle school kids who know, I want to be a mechanic. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to work on cars. I love cars. I want to work on cars for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. That's great. But the vast majority of kids, because of the way that our system works here, mm-hmm. they don't know. In other countries, they do, perhaps. They perhaps do know. But that's because their system from the very beginning is mm-hmm. different.
Right.
They are in tracks and they are in systems to put them in a direction that goes in a particular way.
Right.
Here we don't do that. Here we're much more liberal arts focused. We want to have a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our educational tradition was never meant to be like the European tradition.
Right.
It was done very specifically to be more egalitarian.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's why a lot of these international comparisons that we do really aren't
meaningless,
fair.
Meaningless comparisons.
Because our system is just different.
That's right.
And so, you know, I think that you make a good point that we have to reevaluate what we really need to get from students in school.
That's right.
And again, to me, it goes back to what we were initially talking about with trying to remedy it is it needs to begin with some type of relationship. It mm-hmm. needs to begin with the way in which the parents, the teachers, and the students work together to meet the goals not only of the educational system but of the parents and of the students as well.
Right.
And right now, the only goals that are being met or the only goals that are being focused on are those of the school.
Mm-hmm.
And anything to do with the students, anything to do with the parents is sort of left behind.
Right.
So, you know, that's sort of a big shift.
Well, you know, but you raise a very valid point. And that is that we have to begin to change the parent-teacher relationship.
Right.
I think that's been lost in all the and these schools do not have to be pressure cookers. Most of the pressure is being felt by the teachers, some by the students, but most of it is being passed on to teachers. They're put in an untenable situation. They can't possibly do all that they're being asked to do, and we need to change. But we need to change that relationship, that fundamental relationship between a student and a teacher.
Right.
Make it cooperative rather than adversarial.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. And when we work with, just as a side note, when we work with parents,
mm-hmm.
we tell them the same thing. Right. We have to begin with the relationship between right. the parent and the child.
Can't be an adversarial relationship.
Right.
You got to stop fighting with these kids.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we are about out of time. I told you that we would use all that time with a wrap up. So, that's that. Some things coming up. Next week, October 10th. No, not 10th.
20th.
10th's already passed. The 20th.
Right.
October 20th is our open house here at Psychological Associates of Central Florida. If you're listening to this or you have the opportunity and you're in this area, stop by anytime between 4 and 7 to our office and meet us and meet Ms. Cassie and Dr. Suarez and see what we're doing here, learn about some of the new workshops we have coming up. Very excited about that. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Next one's going to be a good one.
The next one is. So come on in. We've actually had workshops scheduled or planned for the rest of the year.
The next 12 months.
Yeah. So we have them all kind of listed out, and so you can see what we're doing with that, see some of the groups that we got coming up. Mm-hmm. On November 10th, there's where the 10th comes in. November 10th, we are doing a free mental health screening here at the office.
That's right.
You can stop by any time between 8 and 5 and mm-hmm. get a free screening, meet with one of us for about 15 minutes or so. We can look through some things and talk to you a little bit about what's going on and see if there's anything that we could do to help you out. Mm-hmm. On the 13th is our next workshop, which will be medication myths and misperceptions.
That's
right. So check that out. That is up on the web. We'll be up on the website soon, so you can register.
And we offer that for teachers,
right? Teachers and parents and everybody else. So check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and leave messages or leave comments on iTunes. So that's it. Until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
I'm Dr. Richard.
And have a great week.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Life section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.